So let's say you go to vote. Someone approaches you doing a survey as part of the American National Election Study. There are several questions. See how you'd answer this one. Although there are a number of qualities that people feel that children should have, every person thinks that some are more important than others. We're going to show you pairs of desirable qualities. Please tell us which one you think is more important for a child to have. Independence or respect for elders? Obedience or self-reliance? Curiosity or good manners? Being considerate or well-behaved? If you're saying, I'd want my child to be all those things, sure, some of the respondents said that too, and they got marked in the middle. They'd get half a point for each of the answers where they said that. And the people who chose respect elders, be obedient, well-behaved, and well-mannered, they'd get a point for each of those answers. This survey actually has been done by the American National Election Study since 1992, and those with two or more points are considered to skew authoritarian in their values and worldview. The more points, the more the skew.
People who score high on that scale are much more likely attitudinally to take positions in terms of public policy, constitutional issues, you name it, that are authoritarian, that they will take away minority rights, they will aggress towards minorities, and the minority can change over time, and they will look for and obey a strong leader. They like strength.
This is Matt McWilliams, a career political consultant, now, after decades supporting progressive causes and candidates, doing a political science PhD at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's been crunching recent numbers from the American National Election Study, and what he has found is that whether someone leans authoritarian in this study correlates more strongly than anything else with whether that person supports Donald Trump. This is Who Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. So, authoritarianism might make you think of something like this. Or, these days, maybe Vladimir Putin in Russia or Xi Jinping in China. But here, in America? Come on. Well, it helps to define terms. So, authoritarians, as some social scientists describe them, have a strong need for order, a tendency to rely on a strong authority to achieve it, an aversion to ambiguity, a tendency toward black and white thinking, like good versus evil, right versus wrong, a tendency to see the world as us versus them, a tendency to believe force is more effective than diplomacy, and a deep-seated discomfort with change in society. In fact, these points specifically were laid out by political scientists Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler in their 2009 book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. Here's Jonathan Weiler, who's now the director of undergraduate global studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, speaking in 2011 at the University of Arkansas's Clinton Center.
Authoritarianism is an old research program in the social sciences that originally emerged 6 or 7 decades ago to explain why there would be mass support for fascism, for example. And a bunch of researchers started to wonder to what degree people with authoritarian personalities existed in democratic societies like the United States. There's a whole sort of troubled history that this research program went through. It largely fell out of favor by the 1960s and 1970s, but we believe that it has very useful things to say about the political divide in America today.
So Weiler and Hetherington, who's a political science professor at Vanderbilt, took up this line of study, which was also explored by the likes of psychologists Jean Piaget and John Dewey. And now, Matt McWilliams is applying the same research techniques to looking at why Donald Trump has such staying power in this election cycle. So, what does all this have to do with the question, whose century is it? Why is a podcast that's supposed to be taking the long view of trends shaping the century looking at a specific presidential race? Because what I find really interesting, having covered many an authoritarian regime in my couple of decades as a foreign correspondent, is how and when and why authoritarian tendencies can arise, both in political leaders and in a population willing to support them. I'm also interested in whether the narrative Americans would like to believe, that the arc of history bends toward democracy and freedom, both at home and around the world, is necessarily true. In fact, I'm interested enough that I'm going to do a Whose Century Is It Authoritarianism twofer. In this episode, I'll look at how and why these tendencies emerge here in the United States. Next time, I'll look, with considerable help from a knowledgeable guest, at how and why authoritarianism has been waxing and waning globally, and at whether democracy is necessarily inevitable or even likely anywhere. But first, here at home, where to start? How about with this? This is from a Trump rally in Vermont, captured by a film crew for the online news and commentary show The Young Turks. Someone who dares to heckle Trump is being dragged out.
We'll get more and more angry as we go along. Is that okay? And by the end, I'll say, get them the hell out of here. And then, by the way, by that time, the security will be so tough and so nasty. And you know what's going to happen when that happens? You're not going to have any more problems. You're not going to have any more problems.
The crowd likes this. They also like when Trump calls out to the security detail to toss someone out into the cold Vermont winter without his coat.
Don't give him his coat. Don't give him his coat. Keep his coat. Confiscate his coat. You know, it's about 10 degrees below zero outside.
That's chilling in a whole different way than Trump meant it. Cenk Uygur, who's the creator of The Young Turks, had this to say about this incident in mid-January.
If it's joking around, I'm no longer amused. This is exactly how fascism starts. You start roughing people up and you get your own supporters to rough them up. You start taking their stuff. You start throwing them out in the cold. And we've shown you how many videos of now black protesters, Latino protesters, all sorts of protesters, female protesters thrown to the ground, roughed up. Comments like, light the mother up. Now, how about the press? He's always joking about how he's going to contain the press, punish the press, kick the press out. Well, our camera person there, Eric Beiler, and our producer, is recording on Periscope. Let's find out what happened to this journalist.
Eric, our producer and cameraman, also was shut down. He was periscoping from back there while shooting the actual event, and they made him shut that down. Eric was actually assigned a Trump staffer to shadow him and make sure that he would not shoot anything but Donald Trump.
This is just one scene on the campaign trail with Donald Trump, over months when the Trump candidacy has gone from being seen as a lark, to a joke, to a concern, to a question of, well, what if he actually wins? Which begs two sets of questions here, really. First, what does Donald Trump believe, and what would he do as president? And second, what do those supporting him believe, and what did they think he'd do as president? I asked Matt McWilliams what he thought.
I don't know. Not as an academician on this, but as a person, I worry that when you stir up and you engage people in this way, you shape an electorate or reshape an electorate in a way that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They say they're for freedom, but if you look at those questions that I published in the London School of Economics, you would see that attitudinally they don't support a lot of things that are basic to Madisonian democracy, like protecting minority rights. No. We don't like them? No. Religious freedom? I would say allowing Muslims in this country to go to church is kind of like going to their mosque, is basic religious freedom protected under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? No, they're not for it. But there's a public policy poll that said Trump supporters thought Japanese internment was a good idea, which is really scary, especially when you look at it in terms of we're going to deport 11 million people. And then we're going to send them all out and then let them come back in, if the good ones. And it's language like the good ones, which is who decides who's good. The definition of, you know, if you're part of us, you're good. If you're not, you're bad. It's very, very scary language.
The German magazine Der Spiegel agrees. It did an article on Trump and authoritarianism, tracking his language and actions, and arguing that he is indeed acting very authoritarian, and Germans have some experience with this phenomenon. But is this an act? Would a President Trump actually be less extreme than he is now when it comes to policymaking? His Republican rivals have tried to skewer him for not being ideologically conservative enough. On family planning, universal health care, taxing the wealthy, he sounds pretty moderate. But then there's the xenophobic, race-baiting Trump. Which would he be in power? Perhaps we'll never find out, because Trump may not win. Whatever happens, what he has already done is show us a side of America not everyone regularly sees. He has tapped into a pretty deep vein of strong emotion. But why? How? These are some of the questions that Matt McWilliams is now trying to answer in his PhD research, but he didn't set out specifically to focus on Trump. He started his research well before Trump came onto the scene, focusing on authoritarianism and threat and their effect in a democratic society.
I did a quantitative analysis of the 2011 American National Election Survey, EGGS 1 survey, which had the four authoritarian questions on it. And I started to notice some things I thought were statistical oddities within some of the data, which got me to dig even deeper. And I was going to do just three papers because I already had three papers written and one was on authoritarianism.
He went and talked to his dissertation committee.
And the committee said, these other two papers are great. Go get them published. One of them is this 1925 Judiciary Act, which is now about to be published. And they said, but authoritarianism, what you've got here is really, really interesting. And I said, really? They said, yeah. And we spitballed for about 3 hours and came up with an entire, what is now 400 pages of analysis of this.
Matt was able to get 11 questions for his research onto the Congressional Cooperative Election Survey to see how those indicators for an authoritarian worldview correlated to voting preferences. So Matt crunches all his data, writes up his first draft of his PhD, and then Trump starts running for president.
And seeing, you know, the language, the style, the presentation, it all fit in directly with the research I've been doing.
In December, he saw an article in the New York Times which had analyzed a week's worth of Donald Trump's rhetoric. It was called 95,000 Words, Many of Them Ominous, from Donald Trump's Tongue. And it showed that Trump often talked about us and them. They or them were people he felt were problems. Mexicans, Syrians, the news media, who he also called scum. He used the word stupid in public at least 30 times in a week. Much more than most political leaders use that word. He talked a lot about problems. He talked about making America great again. He talked using simple language at a fourth grade level.
Really great article. And they came out and talked about the other. They didn't use the word authoritarian, but they used the word the other and strongman. And the other is, you know, that's who authoritarians aggress against, the other. That's what it's all about. So I just said, oh my God, what we have here is a social science experiment going on in this country. We've been in a threat environment since 9/11. We are reminded continually about threat and vulnerability. So I think we have become sensitized to threat.
And threat is a key variable. It can push those who are non-authoritarian or somewhere in the middle to be more authoritarian, more likely to seek a strong leader who will just keep them safe. 9/11 did that. The Paris attacks, the San Bernardino shootings, had a little of that effect, too. Interestingly, the mass shootings that happen almost every day in America, they don't seem to have that effect. I guess in those cases, it's an American who's shooting, not someone who can be labeled as other, as an outside threat.
You know, the Paris bombings and San Bernardino, the prediction of the pundits was, oh, that's going to hurt Trump because he doesn't have the experience to deal with it. We need someone with foreign policy experience or government experience to deal with terrorism. The exact opposite happened. Trump increased in strength after those because Trump's response was so strong. It was strongman. Yeah.
Matt thinks that's why Trump did so well in the New Hampshire primaries, because New Hampshire isn't a particularly authoritarian state in normal times. But polls around the time of the primary showed that most Republicans there said they were worried or very worried about the threat of terrorism. Then Matt put together another survey with the help of his dissertation committee and ran it nationally, polling 1,800 people around the country.
So the hypothesis was pretty simple. Trump supporters will be authoritarian, and people who don't support Trump won't.
Okay, so Trump supporters would come back at you, and so I'm going to stand in for them and say, we're not authoritarian, we're for freedom. We're for the opposite of authoritarianism.
Yeah, you know, and first, not all Trump supporters are authoritarian, but it was a statistically significant difference. So if you are authoritarian in the scaling of the questions, you are more likely to be a Trump supporter. Predicted probability of supporting Trump if you're non-authoritarian was about 20%, 1 out of 5. If you were an authoritarian, it was 50%, so 1 out of 2. Statistically, that's a gigantic difference, especially when all the other Republicans are like flatlined on authoritarianism across the scale, just totally flatlined.
What do you mean by flatlined? Like Ted Cruz is not an authoritarian?
No, it means he's not attracting statistically people who are dispositionally authoritarian.
It's worth repeating that. For all of Ted Cruz's promises to carpet bomb Syria, for all of Marco Rubio's talk about beefing up border security, they don't get any discernible bump from dispositionally authoritarian voters. On the Republican side, only Donald Trump does. This might be a good time to step back a minute and say, the Republicans don't have a monopoly on authoritarian voters. They have more of them, but that's relative, and it's recent. Polls vary in saying how many authoritarian-skewing voters there are nationally. Matt McWilliams says polls show it's between 18% and 30% of all Americans. He also says that as recently as 25 years ago, there were no huge differences between the percentages of authoritarian voters who identified as Democrat versus Republican. It changed gradually over the last few years as the Republican Party moved right and as many non-authoritarians within it left the party. That said, Democrats still have their authoritarians. Mark Hetherington, the co-author of that book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, he found that in the 2008 Democratic primaries, the higher a voter's authoritarian score, based on those child-rearing questions, the more likely he or she was to vote for Hillary Clinton rather than for Barack Obama. In fact, it was a much closer correlation than for education or income among non-African Americans. African American Democrats scored higher on authoritarianism, but voted for Obama anyway. So you might be thinking by this point, who are these so-called authoritarians? Are they mostly older, less educated white men who feel threatened by social change and a more multicultural America? Not necessarily.
The thing that was really interesting in this survey work, you know, we did 1,800 Americans, voters. We asked a whole bunch of demographic questions right up front. We followed with the authoritarian question. You don't say, hey, here's an authoritarian question. No, this is just a child-rearing set of questions. And then we said, how likely are you to vote in a primary? Those who are likely to vote, Republican or Democrat, so then they sort. So first, I'm likely to vote in a primary. Second, I sort into parties. And then we ask them who they support. And so going through all that, we can then say, okay, now we've got all the supporters of Donald Trump and the supporters of all the other Republican candidates. Let's look at all those demographics. And there were tons, you know, age, income, sex, educational attainment. I mean, all the big, big demographics that drive vote. Not party, because we'd already sorted them into Republican and Democratic parties, right? So we didn't have to put that in. And Trump is what's called the dependent variable, so you support him or not. And all those other variables, which ones are statistically significant? Only two, authoritarianism and fear of terror. That's it.
So do you think what we're seeing is kind of like the lasting reverberation of 9/11 and the war on terror, and that people are just sort of hypersensitized to, you know, have a startle response when there is any incident of terror, where suddenly they retreat to, we need to be strong as a nation, we need to have a strong military, you need to go out and pound those terrorists so they don't come after us? Or is there something else going on that you think accounts for this?
I think that's part of it. But I think, you know, you start with authoritarianism as a disposition. And if we're in a culture or an environment, let's say, where there's no threat, authoritarians will still be vigilant, but they won't be activated.
Again, coming back to your own experience, as you look at what's happening with Trump, as you look at the way that Americans who have been brought up by and large to think of civil society and democracy and freedom and human rights as being shared core values, when you see how people do tend to gravitate toward authoritarian style leaders, how do you end up feeling? I mean, is it kind of like, well, that's the way of the world, or has this been kind of like a cold bucket of water over the head doing this kind of research?
Well, I got to tell you, when I started this research, I didn't think there would be a Trump. And seeing Trump and Trumpism, I think it's interesting that we're turning that into a label, it causes me great concern. You know, I've worked on the Democratic side my whole life, but I've always thought that they're wonderful Republicans too. Nelson Rockefeller, Olympia Snow. I mean, you can go down the list. John Kasich, he does have a good argument to make about what he did in Ohio. And so I think party competition is good in many ways. If we didn't have two-party competition, it would be a bad thing for all of us. But it's that party competition within certain boundaries that are boundaries of civil society, boundaries that say we share certain values and we're not going to turn our backs on those values. Values that allow you to have a disagreement with your neighbor, but still be friends. And the problem is there's no room for that in Trump's language. You're with him or against him. You're a winner or you're a loser. You're making fun of people who are fat, making fun of people who have disabilities. I mean, it's just, to me, well outside the boundaries of a democratic society and a democratic debate. I always think about my mom and how my mom, who fought for this country, and my dad fought for this country in World War II. My mom was in London during the buzz bombs. She was in Paris. She was a captain in the WAC. She was in Paris right after the Germans went out. The general staff came in and she was right there. German snipers all around. She believed greatly in this country. And so my dad, who was at Pearl Harbor. What would they think of this? And they'd be appalled.
Sure. Do you see this as kind of a cycle that we'll get through? Or do you see this as something that could, that has the potential to really turn the tide, that America becomes a very different kind of place? It has a very different kind of political system.
Different political system in terms of the rules? Probably not. Different political system in terms of how it actually operates? Possibly. You know, David Brooks's article in the New York Times, he said, we're making a choice between an open and a closed society. And I think that's right. And, you know, my bigger work, which I hope to get to once I'm through with my dissertation, is to really look at threat and how the threats that we're confronting in the next 20, 30, 40 years could affect our system of government in very significant ways. And I'm concerned just because I see threat level continuing to increase right now, both in terms of economic instability, in terms of terrorism and fear of terrorism, in terms of movement of people. Many of the most movements are caused by global climate change. You know, in Europe, you know, some of that movement is people from areas that are too dry. You know, there's no water in some of these areas because of desertification. Global climate change is going to reshape us geographically in very significant ways. And these are all threats. I see a lot more threats out there than I see happy times. So it makes me nervous. If the response to threat is rising authoritarianism, that's a big concern to me.
President Obama was elected with great enthusiasm and hope that he would be the most progressive president we'd seen in a long time. And in some ways he has been, and in other ways there's been more surveillance. He's invoked executive privilege quite a lot, and in some ways has kind of expanded that power. As you look at what might happen in the next election, say the authoritarian impulses win, Does it worry you then that this new expanded power could be used in ways that hadn't really been anticipated?
Executive power continually grows in this country, and it intrudes on basic freedoms. Surveillance, to me, is, you know, whatever happened to Fourth Amendment rights? You know, there's the Latin saying, in wartime, the law is silent. And we're on a war on terror. We've been in a continual war. And so the law is silent. So our Fourth Amendment rights to protect us from search and seizure seem to just be disappearing. You know, and that's one of the questions in the poll I had was really the suspension of habeas corpus. And people said, yeah, let's do that. So I can define you as a terrorist, put you in jail, and even though you're an American citizen, these people would say you lose every one of your constitutional rights to habeas corpus, which goes back to the Magna Carta, kind of like a fundamental to Western society on our notion of law. So the expansion of presidential power, George Bush expanded it. Before him, it was expanded. It continues to expand. And it can be used for good or evil. It doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican, but any time it's taking away basic freedoms and rights, even if people are willing to give them up, it's still wrong. We've expanded that power under an authoritarian. How could that power be used? That's a very scary thought.
So rather than leave you to just sit and be depressed about the future, there is some reason for optimism. And that is the level of optimism and idealism in the youngest generation of American voters. Republican pollster Frank Luntz polled 1,000 Americans ages 18 to 26 in the first half of February. 88% said they're at least somewhat optimistic about their future. 61% said America's best days are still ahead. 58% said America isn't any better or worse than most other countries. And just over a third said they define themselves as citizens of the world rather than just as citizens of America. Two out of three said that corporate America embodies everything that's wrong about America. And so, authoritarians, watch out. It looks like social change is going to come. On top of all this, by 2020, the U.S. Census Bureau says, more than half of the nation's children under age 18 will be non-white. By 2044, white Americans will be in a minority, and that minority will shrink over time. Building a wall or deporting 11 million illegal immigrants, as though you could, isn't going to change that. Meanwhile, we've got a challenge as a nation to find a balance that best protects everyone's rights and keeps real threats at bay, but not at undue cost to constitutional process and protections. I'll give the last word to Matt McWilliams.
I would just say, good fences make good neighbors. Our Constitution's like a really good fence. And our neighbors, the government, we would like it to stay within its lane, please.
That's our podcast. If you want to learn more about some of the research we talked about and find links to articles and books on the subject, visit our webpage, pri.org/century, where you'll also find all of our previous podcast episodes. You can also subscribe on iTunes. We're also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and most podcast apps. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstead, and PRI's The World, in partnership with the BBC and WGBH. We're funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with part two of my look at authoritarianism and the impact it might have, in perhaps unexpected ways, in this century. Come on back and listen in.